Our last few minutes this hour will be spent with Steve Inskeep. You may know him as the host of Morning Edition on NPR, heard here on the music services of JPR. Steve's also an author with a new book called Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. The subtitle says it all. Steve Inskeep, thanks for joining us for these few minutes on the Jefferson Exchange.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
I understand there's a contemporary political context that launched the project.
Yeah, I got started on this because of my day job. I cover politics in Washington and a lot of other parts of the country, of course. And a few years ago, I got a little discouraged about the state of things, and that kind of drove me back into history and got me thinking about how we got where we are, which drove me back to the beginnings of our democratic system. And that system really began to take shape in the 1820s and the 1830s, which is the period in which this book is set, the period in which these two characters, John Ross and Andrew Jackson, were fighting against each other in that system over real estate.
You can really sense the forming of things that we take for granted today, particularly things like judicial review. John Marshall was still Chief Justice at the time. So a really fascinating period, but also shades of our time. I mean, Jackson's opponents often depicted him as a tyrant. How would you characterize him?
Wow. Well, he was someone who believed in majority rule. But his definition of majority rule was what Andrew Jackson wanted the people must want. And that's okay, and sometimes he was right, and he absolutely was a hugely popular president who had a huge place in the American imagination because he was from the frontier, as it was in that time, and because he was a war hero and had won the Battle of New Orleans and later became the founder of the Democratic Party. It was huge. But you find him at key moments arguing that he has been supported by a majority of the people, even when that is clearly not the case. And when he was battling against Cherokees to get Cherokees off their land, real estate was at the heart of this conflict, it became apparent that the Cherokees had the right to stay, and vast majorities of Cherokees wanted to stay where they were, but that majority didn't matter.
So what was it that made the land so valuable? I mean, this is ultimately a land grab, as the subtitle suggests. I mean, so what was it just that valuable to the white people at the time? They just said, hey, we need this?
It's the sheer scale of it. We're talking about tens of millions of acres. We're talking about the whole region we now describe as the Deep South, the majority of several southern states like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. Those were the states or the future states that were occupied by what are now known as the five civilized tribes, and one of them was the Cherokees. The Cherokees were in northern Georgia and several surrounding states. Their land was valuable just because there were millions of acres of it and there was a demand for it because the United States was growing so rapidly. Here's one of my favorite statistics that I learned. In the early parts of the 19th century, the median age of the United States was around 18. So there were as many people under 18 as there were over 18. The median age now is twice that. We're still not the oldest country around, but we're a much older country than we were, and still growing, but not nearly as fast. The population was exploding by the millions every single decade, and those people wanted land. And so you had white settlers, many of them poor white farmers who wanted land. You also had affluent slave owners who wanted a place to sell their surplus slaves or who wanted to start cotton plantations and sell cotton, which was becoming hugely expensive, hugely pricey, lucrative in the early part of the 19th century. And they wanted a place to expand, and that land was available, and there was an increasing sense. The term manifest destiny hadn't been coined yet, but there was an increasing sense that the continent was the United States for the taking, and that it only sort of technically belonged to these Native American nations who had occupied it for centuries.
Steve Inskeep of NPR News, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about his book, Jacksonland. John Ross of the Cherokees certainly sounds like a more than worthy adversary for Andrew Jackson, though.
He was somebody that I didn't even know about 3 or 4 years ago. Of course, if you were Cherokee, you would learn this history and you would know that John Ross was the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation for decades. I just hadn't heard the name, and I became increasingly fascinated by him. I'm indebted to a scholar named Gary Moulton, who collected years ago John Ross's letters and put them in a couple of books, which I found at the Library of Congress. And you can read hundreds and hundreds of his letters. And so you have an opportunity to explore this Native American leader in his own words as he recorded them at the time. And yes, he was tough. When he gets mentioned in history books, it's sometimes a brief mention, and he's described as a stubborn man. And maybe not that much more. He certainly was stubborn. He held out for more than 20 years against incredible pressure, but he was also creative and thoughtful and interesting and made his way through the democratic system. He was a pioneer trying to do something that had rarely, if ever, really been done before, which was use the American democratic system to defend a racial minority in the United States.
Now, there were third parties here. So who were some of the people, for example, who sided with the Cherokees in their struggle against Andrew Jackson?
Thanks for bringing that up. This was a great political divide, an early battle of American democracy. And, of course, the people who had the vote were all white, or virtually all white, and they were all men. And they were divided. There was a great deal of support for Western expansion. There was this whole idea that America should take the continent, and there were individuals who wanted some land, and they voted a certain way. But there were other people elsewhere in the country who were troubled by this or who felt that the United States had a moral obligation to uphold its obligations to Indians. This even included some people who were in the affected states. Davy Crockett of Tennessee was a frontiersman himself, and he became a congressman, and he actually actively voted against this, voted against what was called the Indian Removal Act. There were white missionaries who were among those who opposed Indian removal, and they activated this network of publishers and preachers and politicians who were Christian, who promoted their idea of Christian values and believed that Cherokee and other Indian rights should be upheld. And there were even women who didn't have the vote, but who signed petitions by the thousands. I think it is the first mass political action by women in the United States.
So the Indian Removal Act, as you have mentioned, it squeaked through the House with votes from people who would have been enraged by Jackson's veto of a highway bill right around the same time. How typical was it of Andrew Jackson to burn his allies quite so clearly?
Andrew Jackson did what he thought was right and what he wanted to do. It is surprising that he upset his friends in this way, because he was also a man who was very loyal to his friends and arranged for his friends to make a great deal of money, and he backed up people who backed up him. So it's a little surprising to see him burn his allies, as you say, and do something that they very much disliked, but hide from them the fact that he was doing it until he got what he wanted. But that's another side of Andrew Jackson. He was ruthless, and he was determined to win. He was willing to get into a fight, and he must never lose that fight. That's a really strong part of his character, and in this case, it was going to be a very close vote, and so he engaged in some rather complicated deception in order to make sure that he got just enough votes to pass this vital act.
So we talked about the executive branch and the legislative branch, and you divide them up well in the book, by the way. So then on to the courts. I mean, how much was Chief Justice John Marshall involved in actually helping tailor a case that the Supreme Court would hear?
This is a story I didn't know at all, that John Marshall did something that I think if a judge did it today, it might be considered unethical, although the Supreme Court has always had its own special set of rules. Justice John Marshall had been watching the fight over the Cherokees and other Indians. He was sympathetic to the Indian cause, and he let it be known to some politicians on that side of the issue that he would certainly be interested in hearing a case on that subject before the United States Supreme Court. Word got back to John Ross, the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, who was working through the democratic system, and Ross scratched together enough money to get a lawyer and to then assemble a legal team and to file a lawsuit before the court. They got there, and John Marshall didn't like their legal reasoning. He wasn't just going to give them a freebie, and so he rejected their first suit. They came back with another one, and this time Marshall ruled in their favor. It's a complicated case, but the essence of it was that Cherokees, although they were under the dominion, so to speak, or the protection of the federal government, had the right to rule their land independently and always had for centuries and had never given it up. And the state of Georgia, which was trying to grab their heartland and establish their laws over their heartland, had no right to do so. That was Marshall's ruling, but it was denounced by Andrew Jackson, it was ignored by the Georgians, and ultimately Jackson figured out a way to make that ruling go away.
Now, Steve, you mentioned that today's political climate sort of launched the project. We were young then. What's our excuse now?
Well, the excuse is we're human beings. We're all imperfect. We're all sinners, as you might say, if you're of a particular faith. And you fight it out in the democratic system with other imperfect people, and you hope that over time we're thrashing toward the light, that we're thrashing toward a better result. That's what they were doing then. That's what we are doing now. And it is very frustrating sometimes to see some of the same human patterns repeated, but it's also fascinating and important to remember that we're not exactly repeating history. We're doing some of the same things today that Americans were doing in the 1820s and 30s, but gradually we're getting better results. We're wrestling with some of the same questions as Americans were in the 1820s and 30s. Here's this big and diverse and growing nation with people from all over. How does everyone get their individual rights respected? How do we make sure, while respecting individual rights, that we have one nation? It's a big question then, it's a big question now, and we're working it through the democratic process.
And well portrayed in the book Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and the Great American Land Grab. Steve Inskeep from NPR News, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, it was an honor.
All right, take care.